You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 40.
People think critically if you give them a narrative with a problem. And then they begin to ask the questions within the confines of that narrative, and then they feel comfortable with challenging each other on their assumptions and on their questions and answers.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to The Local Maximum. 40 episodes. That's pretty cool. I think the podcast seems kind of, you know, much more well-established after 40. You know, when you're sort of at a low number, like six, people are like, well, you might not be doing it for a little while. 40 has some staying power. You know, but I think the big jump comes when I get triple digits, which is sometime in 2020 by my calculation, unless I start doing my shows more than once a week. Which is possible, but not anytime soon. So I'm very happy to give the guest spot on episode 40 to someone who also is a podcaster and who touches on a lot of the same issues with emerging technology that I do. I listened to Charlie's podcast in Tech 2025, and I'm like, hey, you know, this is possible. I can make a compelling podcast about all of these topics. Can the, quote, public actually be interested in machine learning and AI and blockchain, and can they have intelligent conversations about it? You know, that was a risk. And if Charlie Oliver shows one thing, it is a resounding, you know, yes, these topics should be discussed in the public domain. And in fact, if it's only left to experts, they're going to be disconnected from the technology they're creating and the people who are going to be affected by it. And, you know, anyone could just say that, but my guest today actually has some very, very innovative ways of getting the public involved in discussing machine learning, AI, big data, and blockchain, and that's what we're going to learn about today. Now, Charlie's years of experience in the trenches of old media include working in advertising in New York at such media goliaths as BBDO Worldwide and Condé Nast, to producing sitcoms and dramas at Sony Pictures Entertainment, Paramount Pictures, Warner Brothers, DreamWorks, and Oscar award-winning indie production companies, to event management at the Sundance Film Festival. After spending several years in corporate law and document review at global firms, Charlie segued seamlessly into tech and new media as a web video producer, where she co-created and co-produced experimental web video projects. Soon thereafter, Charlie launched Art of Talk TV, a web video platform that brought the world of talk shows online. At Served Fresh Media, Charlie and her team provide digital strategy, senior management advisory, team building and training, strategic partnerships, and product development for companies. In the fall of 2016, Charlie launched Tech 2025, and that's what we're going to talk about today, to educate entrepreneurs and consumers on the next wave of disruptive emerging technologies that are expected to drastically change our world in the next decade. So we're talking, you know, AI, machine learning, driverless vehicles, she had a great one on that, driverless trucks, Internet of Things, blockchain, and virtual reality, among other topics. And she does this through live events and interactive workshops with industry experts. The mission of Tech 2025 is to help entrepreneurs and the general public to understand and embrace emerging technologies. There's also, again, her Tech 2025 podcast, which I recommend you all check out. Let's get to it. Okay, Charlie Oliver, welcome to the show. Welcome to The Local Maximum.
Oh, God, I love your energy. Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
No, it's great. Welcome to Foursquare, New York City.
Exciting. They have new offices.
Yeah. And you came, you're based around here in Flatiron, right?
I am.
We just moved to Flatiron a few months ago.
Foursquare did?
Yeah, we did. We were in Soho until, I think, May, June, somewhere around there.
Can I say something? A couple of years ago, yeah, I was at that location with Fueled. So maybe we were bumping into each other back then and didn't.
I'm sure in the elevator. Yeah, those elevators were very slow. I don't know if
weird.
You remember. Yeah, there are people getting on and off at every floor. I think that's a common thing in New York City, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been doing Tech 2025 podcast and the organization for how long?
Well, it's been almost 2 years. So we technically launched the first event in January 2017.
Okay.
So, recently. Yeah, very recently. Yeah. But it's been 2 years, but it doesn't feel like it.
Yeah. Does it feel shorter or longer?
A lot shorter. But the past 2 years have been very eventful. So
this podcast coming up on almost a year. So it's like, it doesn't feel like that either. It feels like I just started.
Does it?
So, oh, absolutely.
That's a good sign.
Yeah. Why did you start Tech 2025? What was the purpose behind it?
I get tired of hearing myself say this, but it's a
great... Well, no one has heard this on the program.
No one has heard this. Okay. So, you know, I have a company called Surfresh Media, which does digital media strategy and innovation strategy primarily for brands, companies. You know, I work with innovation teams, and I've been doing that for about 9 years now. And that includes, among other things, including like social media marketing and a little bit of PR, innovation strategy, and it also includes events marketing as well. And so I've been doing events through that for years and years, tech events, business events.
So like meetups. Or something else?
Well, no. these are corporate clients, so these events are conferences and panels, and like their goal is to
bigger.
Gotcha. So my clients are like IBM, and when they do their big conferences,
there's
and stuff.
Not a whole lot of money in meetups. I mean, people do it; they do make a little bit, but it's not.
It's not a cash cow. So,
yeah.
So in 2016, you know, I began to hear from my clients sort of a reoccurring theme that was coming to me again and again. And one of the questions that I kept getting was about AI in particular. And what is it? And, you know, there was this not only a question about what is AI and what is machine learning, but how are we ever going to prepare our organizations for it? Like, what does this mean? I think intuitively, the executives that I dealt with and the C-suite executives in these companies that I've worked with, they understood that this was a game changer, right? That they would have to do some really kind of serious restructuring and rethinking about how they run their organizations in order to consider even using these technologies. But anyway, I kept hearing that. And then two other things happened that was, I think, really huge. One had to do with Eric Schmidt of Google.
Right.
And that was in June 2016. He published a Forbes article it was co-authored with Sebastian Throne. And it pissed me off.
Really?
Oh my God.
Okay, what about it? What was so, what did it say? What was so infuriating about it?
You know, I have to tell you something, even to this day when I think about it, I get annoyed.
Oh, I have some. I mean, a lot of times it's either emails or work comments, but not articles.
Exactly. but something that's that long lasting, and it was so the article was basically
I'm putting it on the show notes page now, so we're just giving him
more.
That's okay though. We have to debunk it. If it's, well, who knows? I don't know what it is yet. You got to tell me.
Oh,
maybe
I
agree with it for all.
You know,
I know.
Okay. So I would love to know your thoughts on this. You
okay,
have to tell
it.
Me. Okay. So here's the deal. So here I'm minding my business. I think it was like June 2016.
Yeah.
And the article was basically Eric Schmidt and Sebastian Throne saying in response.
Wait, who's Sebastian Throne again?
He's the founder of, I say Udemy. I think he's the co-founder.
Udemy.
And also Khan Academy.
Okay.
Khan Academy.
Okay,
so he's a brilliant man, you know.
Yeah.
No one's
doubting the intelligence of these people.
Exactly. Okay. And I do give respect for what anyone can accomplish that's of that magnitude. So basically the article was in response to the sort of what I think they perceive to be the unreasonable reaction to AI that Elon Musk and the late Stephen Hawking and people of that ilk were saying, which was that, oh my God, you know, it's you know, the robots are going to come eat us and kill us, and we have to really worry about
they
this.
Eat us. We taste delicious. What?
So the whole article was basically them saying, but the tone of it was very, to me, arrogant, because in the entire article they were like, well, look, stop this nonsense with questioning what AI is and what we're going to do with it. Of course it's going to be amazing. I mean, they are, for all intents and purposes, tech utopianists, right? So their whole position throughout that article was, this is going to be great. AI is going to free us. It's going to make humanity, you know, it's going to enable us to do incredible things. And you guys are basically being silly. So that was the tone of it.
Okay.
I felt when I read it. And it enraged me. And the thing about it that annoyed me the most was that they basically were saying, how dare you question us?
Right.
Just let us do what we need to do and it's going to be great. So anyway, I felt like, well, that may be the case. Maybe it will be great. And I hope for our sake that AI does create the world that you think we're going to be creating. However, it's going to take a lot of pain to get to that point. And there's going to be a lot of people who aren't going to be able to make that transition and who are going to have to sacrifice. And a lot of people always fall through the cracks through transitions like this. So we should be having these conversations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so let's just try to think like on the other side, if there's any way I could play devil's advocate, because it sounds like you might agree. Like, aren't there people, like sometimes I see these warnings about AI that just seem like way over the top.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
So like the idea that somebody's going to flick a switch one day and it's just going to be like Terminator. I don't see it. And
me neither.
Yeah.
But, no, balance so, though, right?
But I do take issue, and I don't know if it's the same issue when Google and Facebook are saying, and I think what you're saying is Google, sorry, I say Facebook too. Maybe you put them in the same category. I criticize them so bad on this
right.
podcast.
It's okay. But, and Facebook is the other part of this, so we'll get to that.
No, is when they say, okay, everything that we're doing is wonderful.
Exactly.
And what do you remember exactly what it was that was his like lead headline on what they were doing too? Because I mean,
the title was, that's what I mean. The title was in itself arrogant. It was, let us stop this foolishness and let us get on with the busy work of AI. That was something like the title.
They're getting on with it. They're getting someone.
Well, I'll tell you the funny thing about this. The funny thing about that is that since then, I was so enraged with that. I don't know why, I was angry because it pushed aside the idea. First of all, it pushed aside the ordinary person who would be, you know, it's like you're a billionaire. That's what I call him, a billionaire.
Yeah.
And if there is negative fallout to this, and there undoubtedly will be, that's in any transition, and you know, that's just a historical fact. You're going to be okay. You're just sitting on your millions. You got your little bunkers everywhere in the world. You can go. But the ordinary person is going to have trouble transitioning, and we have to prepare for that. We have to help them with that. So anyway, fast forward 2 years, he now says, Eric Schmidt, I read an interview with him a few months ago where he is now beginning to say, we have to be responsible about how we implement these technologies. And we have to create, sort of programs for people who are going to be able to transit. I mean, now he's changing his tune, right? But of course, since then, a lot has happened with the big tech companies, and they've had to change their tunes.
Yeah.
So the second thing that happened that year, and this is the big thing, was with Mark Zuckerberg. So do you remember when he made that comment about his platform not having anything to do with the Russian interference?
He made a lot of comments that I've sifted through. That's probably
right.
One of them.
Well, this was the big one that he made when David Kirkpatrick, who is the founder of Techonomy, asked him on stage, was Facebook responsible for, you know, Russian interference in the elections through the Facebook platform? And Mark Zuckerberg was like, no, there's no way. And
how does he know what people are doing?
Well, this is,
he doesn't read the billions of posts going back and forth.
Exactly. Well, here's the thing.
I mean, they won't publish half of my ads, so I don't know.
Really? What are you publishing?
Anything that has to do with Bitcoin or blockchain.
Oh, that's happened to me.
And then I get like the worst kind of like propaganda ads coming into my eyeballs every day, and they won't publish a simple ad where I'm trying to inform the public. It's infuriating.
It is. I'm with you on that. Well, I was sitting in front of Mark Zuckerberg when he said that in person.
Oh, really?
10 feet in front of him at the conference, and this was 2 days after Trump was elected president, after he won the election. And so anyway, I noticed how he, being that close, you can see a person's expression very well, and I remember looking at him going, this guy really believes that there's no way that his platform could cause any kind of harm to this degree. Like, he was disgusted. The look was disgusted on his face.
Especially when they sell ads to politicians. Like, it works, right?
Right. So how could it not?
They sell ads to get everyone out to vote.
Exactly.
I mean, they could theoretically only put out a get out to vote notice to the people they want to see that.
Right.
You know, which
right.
is also, I'm sure they're not. Maybe someone is. I don't know.
Maybe. Maybe. So you can see how that, sitting there, I was pretty disgusted by that because I'm like, come on, dude. So that was sort of the impetus for it. And it was like, you know what? We need to create a platform and a space for people to, number one, learn about these technologies, because I know these companies are not going to invest right now in educating the public. And I feel that they should, personally. I felt very strongly that they should. And the second thing is that, so I think a lot of people missed 2.0. They missed the mobile movement. They missed the original web movement.
I know,
right?
I did. I mean, I missed in a way.
You didn't make money off of it.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm focusing a lot on, like, emerging technology over the last 8 years, because I totally missed, I was in a situation where I was so close, you know, to both of those things.
That's even worse than just, like, missing it altogether.
Yeah, but
like,
it gives me hope that I can hop in this one.
But you can see how this next era, this next phase of technologies that's being powered by AI, I believe there's a window of opportunity here that is, right now it's wide open because no one knows what the hell is going on, including the tech companies. I mean, they're creating these technologies. They don't really know what's happening with them and how to implement them smartly and everything. And so there's a big opportunity for people to participate in this and get a piece of the pie and really own some of this and define it, as opposed to the last era or Web 2.0 where it was defined for them and they just fell in lockstep.
Right. So how do you do that? You do that a variety of ways in your organization.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So the first thing that we do, so a couple of things. Events was my thing, right? Because that's what I do, and I do them in my sleep, right? So I thought, well, first of all, I love the idea of us learning, of us coming together in a social environment. And the question became, how do you get people to learn about technologies that are so exotic to everyone? I mean, in 2017, January, no one was talking about AI chatbots and blockchain and everything. That didn't explode until later in the year. Remember?
I mean, well, 2016, there was a lot of stuff. Well, I was involved in chatbots because of Mars.
Yeah, but you're a techie person. I'm telling you, in terms of it, right? And in
that
New York.
Maybe it was like an echo from, like, the previous year. It was with the, you know, with the Foursquare put out a chatbot, and all of the VCs were interested in chatbots. And then the year after, there's an echo.
Right. But like in January, so chatbots was the first event that we did.
Okay.
It was on chatbots, and it's great that you mentioned
that. That was very topical.
In January 2017, I figured, well, if I'm going to launch, I'm going to do it on chatbots, because I think that's something that the general public, and that's what Tech 2025 is for. It's the general public, meaning any and everyone can come in and have a conversation about these technologies that is open, is accessible to everyone. In other words, most tech events in New York City, you talk about AI, you talk about whatever the technology is, it's full of technologists, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's very hard.
And sometimes it's great, and sometimes it's
too high level.
And, yeah, or some people trying to show how they're smarter than everyone else.
Exactly. And that's
I've
what
seen
I didn't
that
want.
Every once in a while.
Exactly. And that's what I didn't want. And I didn't want people, I feel like, so the challenge that we have, I think, as a society as a whole, is how do you can't get people to participate and to benefit from this stuff until they understand really what it is.
Yeah.
And not just understand what it is now, but if they can, they need to understand how to learn about it as we are developing it, because it's changing. Like every 3 months, it's just whatever you learned 6 months ago, it's done, and now it's, you know. And so, and to get them engaged and to stay engaged. So one of the things that I figured was, well, look, let's do events where, number one, we're not telling people to come in and sit in a chair and look straight ahead and devour information and then leave.
90% of events that I go to.
90%.
Yeah.
Don't you hate those, though?
Sometimes.
I mean, you don't hate them. Sometimes they're good.
Sometimes
they're
good.
Good.
I've even been the guy speaking at several of them.
Okay.
But I try to make it as interesting as possible.
Me too.
But yes, 90% of events are like that. But I've been to one of your events. We could talk about that one in particular. That was a blockchain event.
Yeah.
But, man, you had people getting up, talking, giving their opinion. And usually the only people who ask questions are the people who, like, really want to. But it's almost seemed like it was maybe not mandatory, but kind of like, yeah, you're supposed to get up and talk here.
Yeah.
You don't, you're sort of, you know, you're sort of slinking back a little bit.
Right.
Whereas it's the opposite. It's more like other events, I'm like, I have a question. Should I ask it?
I don't know.
And the question's over.
Yeah, the question's over.
You know, yeah.
And that's a big thing. Okay, so you just named, I'm so glad you said that, because that is crucial. And when it comes to, so in these events, people at the end where there's the Q&A section, you know, you always get the five people who raise their hands and they kind of dominate the Q&A, or they ask questions that are long-winded,
sure,
or, you know, it doesn't really touch on the stuff that people want to know. And then you get the people who are quiet. Maybe they're introverted, maybe they're shy, and they might have great questions, but they don't ask them because, you know, they're shy and they don't want to. Yeah. So the one of the main things that I wanted to do with Tech 2025 was, when people come in to our events, the goal is to not just get the information. The goal is to get the information and to think about it together, and then to create a space where people can feel comfortable, no matter what their background is or their personality type, they can feel comfortable talking about this stuff, because it doesn't get processed in our minds the way it should be if we don't ask the questions we need to ask and talk about it and allow ourselves to be challenged on that. So what you went through with the blockchain one, which is what we do, those think tanks, is when I say break up into groups, I tell people, I don't care who you go into a group with. It's, let's just find five other people you can stand for the next hour. And here's the problem. Those self-governing groups, when five people come together and they're given a problem and told you got to solve this and you got to do it now in like 20 minutes, it's amazing how that group of people will find a way to allow everyone to have a voice. And I've been told by people who are really shy, they come in and they're like, I can't believe I was able to say something and they heard my opinion and I didn't even think that I felt the way that I did until I started talking about it. That's what we need. When you want to talk about how we're going to develop AI and implement it smartly and fairly and equitably, we've got to make sure that we can help people who don't usually have a voice at the table to not only have a voice, but to understand that it's a voice that's needed, right?
Yeah, so I mean, it sounds like it works great. Can I ask, because I've been to some meetups where, you know, people ask questions, I've been to panels. Mm-hmm. So one problem that you have is sometimes someone comes in and, you know, it's open to the general public.
Right.
So sometimes you have someone
you don't
who
know
kinda,
what you're gonna
they
be.
Kind of hijack things. Yeah. They kind of talk for a while. They're maybe not making a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. Like I've been on a panel where someone gets up on a soapbox and I'm like looking around, they have a panelist, like, right. Is someone going to stop this guy?
Right.
Like, do you ever have that problem at your events? Or?
I have literally, that's a great question, because I hate that. Yeah. Everybody does, right? Everybody does. So two things. I think it starts with, and most people don't know this about our events, but it starts with how you speak to your speaker, the speaker of the event. We usually only have one speaker, and I do that for a reason. And when I invite my speakers in, I make it clear to them. So the goal of our events, of our think tanks, is not just that people come in and learn, but that the speakers learn too, right? So I am mindful of the fact that my responsibility is not just to the audience and giving them something that they can think about and walk away with, but that the speaker has to do the same. So we all get to challenge each other here. And one of the things that sort of mitigates that type of thing is that when people, I don't let people ask questions. It sounds crazy, but I don't do Q&As at my events. We didn't do a Q&A then.
Okay.
You remember that? We did not do a Q&A.
I don't remember, because we were talking so much, I almost, in my mind, it's like as if we did a Q&A.
See, you are brilliant, and that is why I don't do Q&As. I substitute that experience of talking so much with each other. And I mean, once you tell, so here's what I've learned.
It's almost like a cultural assumption now. You go into not now, it probably was for a long time. You go into a talk, you hear the person talk, then you do a Q&A, and they say there's no more time for Q&A.
Yeah,
like
and
it's every single time.
And doesn't everybody feel cheated? Like, you feel like, dude, come on, you know?
I usually spend the entire Q&A thinking of a question that I never asked.
That you never, okay. I love the way you think, because that is exactly what it feels like, and it's the most frustrating thing in the world. And I said, no, we have to change that. We have to turn that on its head.
Okay.
And the way that I figured out, at least as far as I see it works for us, is that the assumption is that people understand how to ask questions about these topics. And I'm telling you that they don't. We don't.
Okay.
Because these topics are so exotic, they're new, and they are intimidating. All right. And even if you get the developers that are technologists, and like 35% of our community are like engineers and coders and everything, they may not even necessarily understand how to ask the questions that they are trying to ask, that and phrasing them in a way that everyone can understand them, right? So I did away with the assumption that people, number one, know what they want to ask, or that if they do know what to ask, that they know how to ask it constructively, right? And so I said, then we're going to get rid of questions. And what I did instead was give them a problem to solve. If you give them a narrative, people think critically if you give them a narrative with a problem. Then they begin to ask the questions within the confines of that narrative, and then they feel comfortable with challenging each other on their assumptions and on their questions and answers. So believe it or not, by the time the night is over, each group actually presents their solution to the speaker, right? It's like, here's our solution. And sometimes the quietest person in the group will get up and take the mic and say, this is what we came up with, and da-da-da. And usually the quiet person a lot of times has like the best idea. It's really funny. And so they'll get up and say something, and then by the end, they actually don't have any questions to ask, or those questions that they thought that they had, they were able to talk out. And I think that's more substantive.
Yeah. Yeah, can you give an example? Maybe was there any particular event that sticks out in your mind where it went a very different way than you thought, or you learned something, people had way different opinions than you thought? I see. I can tell there are several, but yeah. We can talk about a few.
Well, first, do you have some vodka? Do you have a drink?
There's beer on tap.
There's beer on tap? Okay.
There's an event down there, though. I can't.
I'm going to go down
here. I already went down there and asked them for a cord, and they're like, this is a work event. What are you messing with us for? Oh, well.
You know, it's a learning process. It's a very much a learning process for me. And there are two events that, so what no one is talking about, at least I don't hear them talking about it, is the fact that people are changing how they're thinking about technologies very quickly. It's you know, the assumption is that the consumer and that the general public is just kind of like humming along, and that these technologies are going to be dropped on them, and that they're going to be like, okay, this is great, let's try this. Now, that may have been the case, you know, for Web 2.0. That may have been the case for mobile, because, you know, you swipe, and this is a real simple device to use. But I think for AI, machine learning, blockchain, these technologies, that's actually not going to happen. And what we're hearing and what we started seeing last year, it's been 2 years now, so we've done over 50 events here and including in Toronto, is that in January 2017, people were very innocent about it and very kind of just curious. You know, they come in and they're very positive and open. They're still positive, but in December 2017, something very different happened, and there were three events that blew us away.
Really?
That with regards to, and I'll only mention two, but it blew us away in the sense that we really began to see the attitudes of people seriously doing a 180. Hmm. Like, in other words, we began to see a cynicism in the audience and in the questions and in the way that they were talking that wasn't there before. Now, it kind of makes sense, because you got to imagine in 12 months they had seen a lot of scandals with the big tech companies. This was a year of dealing with politics that was really exhausting, right? I mean, and they come in with all of that.
Yeah. I've been asking, well, not to bring it back to Facebook, but I've been asking this question of people, name a feature Facebook's put out in the last 5 years that's made your life better. And people have a hard time with that answer.
Really?
Because I remember 10 years ago, Facebook, Google, all these companies where every few months you're like, wow,
yeah,
you know, I can tag my photos, or wow, like autocomplete or whatever. And now it's just like, yeah, they're saying we don't do this anymore. They're like taking away features.
That's a good point.
And it does, I think it is making people cynical.
No, it is.
I see this here a little bit too. I feel like our business models are, you know, have all veered towards advertising. And
right.
So the you know, big data, a lot of, you know, there's a lot of applications to big data, but it's all towards targeted advertising.
Absolutely.
There's some good things about that, but it's sort of, it took the focus on building great products for people away.
Like, absolutely.
It took the focus away from business. So, and
absolutely,
I think that's really been coming to a head over the last couple years.
I think so. I agree with you with that. And I have to tell you, the two events in December that kind of blew us away, because we were averaging about three events per month the first year.
Okay.
We went hard, because I said, I want to know, you know, I kind of have to define what people are, try to figure out what people are thinking and what they want. So we did a lot of events. But one event was the Ohio Tech Challenge. And we did that in collaboration with the Ohio Tech, basically, the Ohio government had this challenge, and it was basically open to anyone in the world. And the challenge was create technology, whether it be, you know, whatever it is, AI, blockchain, we don't care, just create technology that could help us in the battle against opioid addiction, right? And that I thought was really compelling. And I said, okay, and it was a great big, you know, prize. And I said, we'll bring that here. And so they loved that. We actually got on the phone with them, and they came out, and we had a great event. But here's the thing. At the event, which was full of people who were, it was a mixed crowd, but a lot of the people at the event were people who were very close to that subject. They were drug treatment center employees and people who had been, you know, working into some capacity with regards to opioid addiction. And so we had Dr. James Phan stand up and talk about the potential for using machine learning and helping us in AI and helping us to help people addicted to, you know, to opioids and to help them understand what their addiction is and to be able to temper them, you know.
Right.
Okay, so the audience hated that.
Really?
And the funny thing is, and this made us go, what the hell is going on here?
Oh, what? Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah, because it shocked me. So this particular audience wasn't really our normal, usual audience, because like I said, when we do events, anytime I do events, because I'm an event marketer, I don't rely on just marketing to our community. So if I do an event about opioid addiction and technology, yes, I'm going to go to our usual, you know, Tech 2025 crowd and then in the, you know, business audience, but I'm also going to go to first responders. We invited police departments, first responders, doctors, we, you know, all of the stakeholders. I said, come out here, participate, learn something, to, you know. Well, when Dr. James Phan came and I asked him to come, now he is the co-creator of IBM Watson's Q&A, the one that beat, that one on Jeopardy.
Yeah,
15 years
what
ago.
What are those guys' names?
I forget. It's a long time
Ken
ago.
Ken Jennings.
Was it Ken Jennings?
The Jeopardy Grandmaster.
Yeah.
They're called Grandmasters.
I think it did.
And there was one other guy up there. But was that 10 years? That wasn't 10 years ago, was it?
No, it was 15 years ago.
No. Because I remember, I remember working with Foursquare. Maybe I was in grad school.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Come on now.
That wasn't 15 years ago.
It wasn't? Okay.
More like 8 or 7.
Oh, okay. So, okay.
I will look it up.
we should place a bet on it. Because I thought James was the one who told me it was 15 years. I could be wrong. I could be wrong. But he gladly came, and my thing with him was, James, could you just talk to them really briefly, because we didn't have a lot of time, about some of the what machine learning and AI is, and sort of don't make it a high-level talk. He knows that because he's spoken for us before. And just try to kind of help people to understand what the future is with regards to machine learning, AI, and these technologies, and helping us to understand how to deal with this epidemic. The more he talked, the angrier they got.
Really?
And what I found was that people were so angry, they were standing up and they were like practically yelling whenever he was the more he talked, the more they kept saying, no, robots can't tell us what we feel and what we should do. And it was shocking.
Yeah.
It was shocking to me. And I looked at my media coordinator, Rebecca, everybody knows Rebecca. She's amazing. And we were just like, what's going on? Like, where's this anger coming from? But they were angry. And so I said, okay. And I kept giving James a look because he's talking happily on the mic. I should tell you something. Dr. James Phan has an unbelievable amount of enthusiasm when he is teaching about AI. He loves it, and it comes through. And so he's happy. He's on the mic, and he's not registering that there's this backlash. And so I ended up taking the mic from him, pushing him off stage, jokingly. You know, I was like, okay, thank you very much for coming. And I instead asked people. That was the first event where we had such a strong negative emotional response to AI and even the potential of the technology, which is all he was talking about.
Yeah.
And so instead of allowing them to continue to make comments, I told them, okay, save that. It's time to break out into groups. Here's the questions for you guys. And that helped them a lot. They talked through it, but they were still very concerned about the technology, and that's weird.
What were people concerned about? What were they
primarily? Yeah. Because we did record it. I'm not publishing that because it wasn't for publication. But
yeah, well, why do you think people got so angry?
I think that, so two things. This was in December of 2017. So there's always more at play when people say that they're angry about the potential of technology to limit them or their lives in some way. There's always more going on than just the technology, right? So there's something that's fueling that fear that's beyond the technology and deeper than it. So I think a lot of that had to do with the politics of what was happening at that time. And I happen to think that the more powerless people feel, or the less powerful people feel, I should say, the more that they project that powerlessness onto the things that might actually empower them more, which is
right.
So I think I can tell you for sure that the big thing they hated was the idea that an algorithm can tell them how they are thinking or what they are really feeling, or give them options outside of what they think they should do. Especially, it's a control thing. It's all a control thing.
So they feel like they're losing control if you have a device, even if if we're the product developers, we build it as a recommendation engine, not a not a controlling engine, but it's being perceived as a controlling engine.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, and look, I could be wrong, but I think from my perspective, what I saw was that this event was about the idea of helping people who are addicted to opioids and the stakeholders who are in the battle to figure out how to help them. And people see that as a distinctly human transaction. Like this person is addicted to drugs. There should be a limited amount of technology involved. You cannot, the caring part of this where we tell another person how they should think and feel and what's going on, that is a very human thing. And it's almost an affront to our humanity that you think that, AI or machine learning or whatever, or an algorithm
can replace that. Reduces to an algorithm. People exactly. Don't want to believe that they can be reduced to the algorithm, and they can't, but...
That's not what's happening.
But algorithm can help them, yeah.
Exactly. That's not what's happening. So that was huge. That was the first one. And the other one was, and that shocked even Dr. James Phan. We had a great conversation about that. And then the other thing, this was even more shocking, was we did a blockchain event, and it was our first blockchain event.
Yeah, it's not the one I went to.
No, that was the second one.
Right.
I was very careful about introducing blockchain to our audience and cryptocurrency. We actually didn't introduce crypto events at all.
Yeah.
I wouldn't touch that because, again, people have their preconceived notions. They're very afraid of it, and I just want to make sure I'm introducing it in a way that is not going to add to their confusion, but that will help them to think about it in a more constructive way. So with the blockchain thing, I thought to myself, okay, let's do an event. Have you heard of Civil Media?
No, I haven't.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so Civil Media is the blockchain journalism platform. So it's like... It's a platform for news media using blockchain to power.
So I feel like I understand blockchain pretty well, but I never know how these things are going to work. Like what's the application of blockchain to journalism?
Right. Okay. So I love
that
you said.
Was that the
No. Here's the thing. I love the way you say it, the way you phrase things, because that's exactly the problem, right? Even the people who are in it, and when I say I'm in blockchain, I mean, I'm a part of a lot of the conversations that are happening. I get asked to speak on it, but I'm not an expert in it. And even the experts in it will tell you that it is very much in its infancy, right? It's not regulated yet. I mean, we're still struggle to understand. But however, as opposed to cryptocurrency, let's just look at the blockchain, the potential to help.
So for those of you who are, it helps me to think of blockchain as a database that kind of lives in the ether that is unchangeable, cryptographically unchangeable, which means that there's a lot of security on it and no one owns it. So just for those of you who aren't, for those of you who want a way to think about what we're about to say. Because I can feel, even though this isn't out yet, this isn't live, I could feel people are starting to panic.
Yeah, you know what? That's a great point. And you can say trigger words like that, like blockchain and cryptocurrency, and you can literally see the people's eyes, like, their eyeballs begin to...
It's hard enough to explain Bitcoin, and then within like a year, you had to explain 100 different other things going on.
Exactly.
I needed 10 years just to explain that one.
Well, how about this? We were going to do an event in September on cryptocurrency, on how to teach cryptocurrency to your kids, right? Yeah. That was the essence of it.
And the crypto for toddlers.
Right. Well, the title was how to teach cryptocurrency and blockchain to your kids when you barely understand it yourself.
Right.
Because people don't understand it, but they still have to begin to talk to their kids about this stuff.
Right.
And it's really intimidating. No one wants to look like a dope when they're talking about this stuff, especially to your kids, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so it is what it is. So with this blockchain...
They probably know more. You probably like start talking to them and they're like, but what if it's a multi-sig transaction? I'm out of here. I'm sorry.
Well, that's why I didn't have kids.
Go ahead.
That's hilarious. Yeah. So the think tank that we did, this was actually 2 weeks after we did the opioid one, it was called Using Blockchain Journalism to Reinvent Hyperlocal News into a Community-Driven Profitable Business. And that was with Daniel Seaberg. I say Seaberg, I think it's Seaberg, from Civil Media. Now, Daniel was the co-founder of the Google News Lab. Google Media News Lab. And so he had been with them for, I think, 10 years, like a long time, sort of traveling the world and building that part of Google for them and everything. And so when I saw that they were doing this, it came on the heels of that billionaire, what was his name? The billionaire who actually pulled all of the hyperlocal news sites from publication. He basically shut down his entire media empire.
Oh, I don't.
No,
that doesn't ring a bell.
Well, I'll have the name for you in a second, because this was the impetus for the events, because we try to make sure that when we talk about these technologies, we do them within the confines of a narrative that's, number one, realistic, right? Something that's happening now, and something that ordinary people can just get. It's easy. So it was Joe Ricketts.
Okay.
So he's
I haven't heard that name.
Yeah, no, he's a billionaire, and he's basically a billionaire who he ran like DNA Info. Remember DNA Info?
Sure.
And like a lot of the hyperlocal news sites across the country. So his journalists, they unionized, and he said to them, if you unionize, it's a wrap. I'm not dealing with unions. This is, you know, and they did anyway, and they in that same day he shut down all of the publications across the country. So it was kind of shocking, right? Like, there's like, I mean, which...
Never heard of this.
Yeah, it was a big... Well, it was a big thing. Yeah, no,
right? How did I miss this?
Yeah, it was a big thing. And the thing is that I got into a couple of... You know, I had a conversation with someone who... We talked about this, and I thought, what Civil is doing at that time, they had not launched yet. Civil didn't launch until June of 2018. May, I think.
Okay.
Of 2018. And we got them in December of 2017.
Right.
Daniel Seiberg had just come on board, and they had just raised several million dollars. I think they had like, at that point, I think they had like $3 million, if that much, in funding. And so I thought, well, they want to tackle hyper-local news using blockchain. And I thought, maybe that's a great way to have a conversation with the general public, that because everybody, you know, the public reads these hyperlocal news sites, and especially in New York City.
Right, right.
Right?
In Brooklyn, hyperlocal news has been big. I mean, I was doing some projects in that.
Back really?
In like 2006, 2007.
What
yeah.
do you mean by projects? Well, it sounds very
I talk about Sticky Map on the show a lot. I'll tell you about it after the show, because I don't want to get into it.
Is it legal?
Oh, yes. It was not. Yeah. Yeah, it's still up, but
it's still up. Oh, okay. Oh, so it's a website.
Yeah.
Okay, I have to find it.
Yeah.
Okay. So you can appreciate, especially in New York City, how that hyperlocal thing. So I invited them to come speak, and I knew that they did not yet really. I don't think they had even presented anywhere before. So we were like one of the first places that they even presented.
Okay. Test point.
Test point. Yeah. And the first thing I said to them was, "You are my first blockchain event." And this audience is definitely a diverse audience. You're going to get blockchain people in there. We're going to have journalists in there. You know, it's a mix. You cannot make this talk high level. So I work a lot with our speakers, because the people who are coming in here are used to giving high level talks. And they, for the first time, have to give a talk that not only software engineers or coders can, you know, be interested in, but that a 75-year-old who comes in from God knows where, it says, "Hey, I want to practice." That happens. Yeah. We get a lot of baby boomers who come in, and that's great.
Yeah.
So anyway, I said to Daniel, "Look, Daniel, let's keep this within the narrative of this hyperlocal news thing, and pretend that your publication, what you're doing, your platform is a solution to that, so that they can then begin to see how." You know what I'm saying? Yeah, that was the thing. Anyway, he showed me the presentation. I thought it was still too high level. But I thought, okay, he did a great job presenting it, but I got to tell you, I mean, and he was so thoughtful in doing it, and he told them flat out, which I loved, "Look, I'm just learning this myself, so I'm here to learn from you." Well, they gave him the feedback, and it was shockingly negative.
Wow.
Shockingly negative.
Like, I'm surprised that people are comfortable doing that in that kind of a setting.
Okay, that's a fair point. And I will tell you, I don't think that they necessarily would be, but I think it's because I prime the audience. Like, the thing that I say at every event is, number one, you know more than you think you do. So stop believing when they tell you that you don't know anything and that you can't figure this stuff out. Stop believing that. It's a lie. You've been walking around with a computer in your pocket for at least 8 years now. So you intuitively understand AI and this stuff more than you think you do. And not only that, they need you. They need your solutions. They cannot do this without you. For the first time ever, with regards to technologies, these companies cannot bulldoze their way through us anymore. That's just not an option. So say what you need to say. And then I tell them that a lot of times what they say to us in here actually does get back to, because it has. You know, my connection tech, we talk, and the speakers who come in, a lot of times they will take what our audience says, and they will take it back to their teams and go, "Wow."
Oh, sure.
So I think people feel, it's important to make people feel comfortable and like they can say what they want to say. So this room did that. And this room was diverse. They were blockchain people. They were journalists, hyperlocal journalists of some of the publications that you probably know. And we were shocked at how they were just very, very vocal about the fact that they didn't get it. They didn't see the need for it. And they felt like the token was unnecessary and complicated. And and whereas with your blockchain group, remember how active and hyper it was? And everybody was just like all over the place and talking.
And that was the one with Clyde Vanell. That was the Clyde. I should mention, linked to episode 29.
Hey. And and he just won again. He's back in the Senate.
Oh, he did?
Yes,
okay.
He did. Congratulations, Clyde. Yeah, so these guys were very visibly sort of disturbed by what they saw in this presentation. And it shook us. It shook me because in my assistants, because we were like, what? Now, we know blockchain can be confusing and everything, but there was something really disturbed. They felt was disturbing.
Well, I can imagine, and I don't know what the situation is, but I imagine if it was something like, oh, I write a good article and then I get tipped and then there's money, but then it's like, do you need a token for that? I don't know.
It's very good because some of the feedback that came in was like the token thing. They just really hated that. And two things. I have to say, I did sort of, sometimes I stirred
a pot. How many people even know what a token is?
This is my point. And this is supposed to be the value of the money, right? So that's a huge thing.
I was listening to Andreas Antonopoulos the other day explain the difference between a cryptocurrency and a token. And he said,
did you get it?
Yeah. He said, a cryptocurrency has its own blockchain, and a token is like a, you could have a token on Ethereum, so it's like on a different block. It's like a byproduct of another blockchain, but that's not the main currency of that.
You understood that.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand it too, but do you think like your aunt or uncle would understand that?
It's tough.
Like,
it's the first try to get, I mean, if you can't even get the original, how does a blockchain work down?
Right.
I mean, eventually we're all going to get this without knowing all the,
I worry about that.
All of the basics, but somehow I don't know how people are gonna.
Well, you know what's funny?
Like, people don't know how money works now, so.
Well, you make a valid point because my media coordinator, Rebecca, by the way, I mentioned her again. Hey, Rebecca, she has been to every event. She has worked at every event that we've done, with the exception of two. And that night was so shocking to both myself and my staff that we were just kind of like, what just happened? Wow, this is weird. At the end of the night, we have this ritual where we walk to the train station together and we sort of debrief about what happened that night. And Rebecca said to me, Charlie, this is the first event that we have done where I'm actually afraid for the future. And I said, wait, what? Like, come on. We've done events on everything and like killer robots. She said, there's something about that presentation that really makes me afraid, and I don't know what it is. So she went home and thought about it, and she came back to me, a few days later, and she said, she wouldn't mind me telling you this because she said this on our podcast too, but she said, okay, I figured it out. I'm 20, she's in her 20s, she's like 23. And she said, her whole life, everybody has been telling her, parents, the government, everyone, teachers, that she should save money, and that money is the value of what she does and who she is. Right? And so she feels like she has a fair understanding of that system, even though it's a, she says, and now along comes this new system that's replacing what turns out to be, money just turns out to be an idea. It's not even like a real thing. This is her talking to me, by the way.
Yeah.
She says, so now you have one idea being replaced by another idea that no one understands, but we, meaning millennials, are going to have to figure it out.
Yeah.
And no one has a clue what it is. And she said that scared the crap out of her. And it also, she said, sort of made her like, this is, So when I talk to, she doesn't represent all millennials, of course. I'm not saying she does. But when I talk to people who are coming up, and I do, I talk to a fair amount of like young people because I want to get their feedback. It really concerns me that they are so concerned too, because I hear that from a lot of them. I mean, I go to lunch and a lot of them will come up to me at our event and say, can I talk to you? Can I, I want to get your feedback on something. And I ask them about these technologies and they'll figure it out. Let's be real. They will figure it out. I don't doubt that. But they are concerned too. So this event, after that event, I sent this civil team, I sent them an email and I said, look, I hope you enjoyed the event. I hope you got a lot out of it. Here's why I think it went left. And here's maybe how you can still benefit from that. It takes some of that feedback.
What was the, was there a main, theme to like the opposition to, was the opposition to like the concept of a token, or what was the
That's a great
main
question. So there was a couple of things. Definitely, I think unanimously, there was an opposition to the idea of the token. There was also not only what that token represented, but the underlying premise that they should have to pay for news that they are going to be. See, the thing is that we have been fed a steady diet of free media.
Yeah.
You know, and even though that's changing, because sites are now like kind of switching over to subscription models, and I think that's a good thing.
And I think that, yeah, and I think it might be a problem. We have free, not just free media, we have free everything online.
Yeah.
And as it kind of shields, I mean, it shields the producers from the price system.
Right.
So there could be a number of problems with that. On the other hand, it allows everybody to access it. So I don't know what the answer is, but I recognize it's a big problem.
It's a big problem. And not only that, I have to play devil's advocate. So
yeah.
I stood up because I, as they call it, I stirred a pot. I said, well, guys, consider this. Consider the fact that Civil and platforms like Civil is talking about getting rid of the middleman. And that's one of the things that Daniel said that he felt proud about.
Yeah.
And I said, well, now, wait a minute now, okay, because we know the middleman is the advertiser. Think about what it means to get rid of the middleman. That middleman may be annoying, and it may have, obviously, advertisers cause us a lot of problems and everything, and it's a broken model. But if you get rid of the middleman, who's going to pay for the content? Who's going to get, like, that middleman is not going to let you go that easily because you're their bread and butter.
Right.
So if that's the case, you have to condition yourself to understanding that that's going to create a battle that you may or may not benefit from, right? So that, I think, made people begin to think, oh, wait a minute, what is this? And then this other guy raised his hand and said, I could actually game your system right now.
Yeah.
And Daniel was like, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, he was a developer. Well, I can, get my own newsroom and do this. He literally thought it out. In the media.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Daniel was like,
people are always trying to think of that.
Yeah, we were looking at him. He was like, yeah, so I just basically gamed your whole platform. And I felt bad because I was like, wow. But that's what these events are for. You challenge the speaker on what they're talking about so we can all learn. And Daniel, to his credit, was great. I mean, he was open. He listened. I could tell he was probably a little agitated, as anybody would be, because it's like, what is going on here?
Well, it's interesting, because I've been to some events, and it's usually like, you don't challenge the speaker, and that's a problem, because then you don't get any feedback.
Yeah, right.
And then I feel like if I ever am challenged, it'll be tough to deal with.
I think I'm going to come to your event just to heckle you.
Yeah.
But, and that's, I warn all my speakers ahead of time. I say, look, you might be challenged. I'm there. I've got your back. I'll give you a hug. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Like, you'll be okay. So after the event, I emailed the team and I said, guys, if you want any more feedback, like, here's what I thought happened. I would love to know what you think. Anyway, fast forward like 9 months and they had their token sale. And unfortunately, it didn't do well at all. And they had to refund everything.
Yeah.
But ironically, a lot of the feedback that they were getting from journalists and from people was similar to the feedback that we gave them in December.
Mm. Interesting.
Well, it underscores the point that the general public knows more than we think they do.
Yeah, or whatever reaction they're going to have, you can guarantee other people are going to have that same reaction. You're right. It's almost like you're providing user research,
That's exactly it. And actually, speaking of research,
that's what people around here, when we put out a new version of Swarm, we don't just say, this looks good. Like, you actually have people use it, and then you're like, oh, God, they'll never find that button in a million years.
Right. and then don't they surprise you when they do? People just surprise you with what they see. I've been shocked by some of the stuff that I've heard. I've been like, oh, God.
Yeah.
And there are things that I've learned about how I think about this stuff that I realize is sometimes very narrow too. I've had to learn oh my God, I'm being insensitive to certain people here that I thought, I pissed off truck drivers at one point and I didn't mean to do that.
You had an episode on self-driving trucks.
I thought
that was great, because I learned so much from that episode. I didn't know anything about
Was this the online one or the real, the one in,
we did, I don't remember. It was a podcast episode.
Oh, it was a podcast. Okay. Well, we did three events on self-driving trucks.
Yeah.
And one of them I marketed on Facebook and sent out. It was on truck drivers being replaced the truck driver shortage and how the technology is driving that. So anyway, we did an ad on Facebook, and literally truck drivers from across the country started leaving posts underneath the ad, and they were angry.
Oh, yeah. But I mean...
No, and I don't take...
That happens.
It happens, but here's the thing.
That happened in Foursquare. We put our ads on Twitter to, like, get people to join Foursquare, and it's, like, pictures of us, and people, like, criticize the way we look.
Yeah, but, like...
If it's a man, they're like, oh, another white man in town. And then if it's a woman, you get like the alt-right guys being like, just hiring women just to show their diversity. They probably don't know what
and
they're
doing. And if there's one black person, it's like, oh, there's a token black person.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's just, I'm like, this is just us. This is just how
it's
we look.
It's a photo. This is, we all work here, yeah. I promise you.
I just have this theory. We're too good looking for them. We're too good. That's what I tell my coworkers.
But can I tell you something? That ad, it turned out, I think I was responsible for the negativity of that ad, and that when I began to listen to all, I read all of the, you know, I feel like if people want to express themselves, as long as they're not cursing and being disrespectful, fine.
Yeah.
And I was learning a lot hearing, because the truck drivers started tagging each other. That's how it went viral, like in the comments. They were like tagging each other.
I imagine they're a pretty tight-knit community.
They are a tight-knit community. And I've learned a lot about them. And so what happened was I had been reading it throughout the day and reading the comments, and they were making some of them were making really good substantive comments. Like, oh, really? You want to hire more truck drivers? This is what you do. This is what you do. But one truck driver said one thing that literally made me go, oh my God, that's it. After all of the rest of them had their back and forth, he said, well, because the topic of the title of the event was, how can we get women and millennials to fill 250,000 truck driving jobs? Right, or it was something like that.
Okay.
When the current crop of drivers who are averaged age 55 retire in 10 years, like how are we going to get millennials and women, which is what we need in those jobs, to fill them? And so he said, well, if women are replacing us or driving the trucks and the machines are driving the trucks and the millennials are driving the trucks, what's going to happen to us men? What's going to happen to the men? And it was an innocent question, and it was it's you kind of feel that he was just really confused.
Right.
And I looked at the title of my event, and I realized how insensitive it was, because it was pushing aside the drivers who are there now as if they already don't matter.
I've experienced that too, where I created some like marketing copy or whatever, and then I the next day I'm like, I shouldn't have written it like that.
Really?
I'm not trying to think of a specific example.
Because I want to know
can't
now.
A specific example, but I know I've been there before.
Did you get backlash for it?
Nobody's my audience isn't that big yet for backlash, but one day if I start getting backlash, then I know I've grown my audience to the size I want.
Well, show me your ads. I'll give you backlash for free. I'll
okay,
backlash.
Sure.
I'm from Brooklyn. I can give you backlash.
Good. That's why I moved to Brooklyn, to get the kind of
that type of Brooklyn doesn't exist anymore.
I know.
Yeah, but so it's been a quite a learning experience, again, it's positive. It's people.
Yeah.
I think are more engaged now. I'm seeing them wanting to do more.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we've exhausted our time. Why don't we? Let's say if someone wants to learn more about this, where would they go?
Okay. Well, the website is tech2025.com.
Okay.
That's tech2025.com. Yeah. And follow us anywhere in social media. It's Join Tech 2025.
And the podcast.
The podcast. Yes.
I listen to that.
Do you?
Yeah, and my co-host, Aaron, who people who listen to the show will be familiar, he listens to it too.
Does he?
So, yes, he does.
Do you have constructive feedback for me?
I'll ask him. It's hard to get a hold of him.
Oh, I'm asking you.
No, it's great.
You hesitated.
I mean,
you SOB.
I'm trying to think. Too many people asked me for feedback recently, and I'm like, I just listen to stuff that I like. So
no, well, I want your feedback, even if it's I want to get better. I do, but we're only three.
I mean,
seasons
I'm in the
in.
Same boat here.
Yeah, but you're crushing it.
So I'm
you're crushing
to,
it.
Trying to improve this. All right. Anything else you'd like to add about all this before we head out?
No, I mean, I just check it out, come out to the events. We'd love your feedback. Follow us on social. If you guys have ideas for some of the topics that we should be discussing at live events, we're doing one in a few weeks called, it's the dark side of automation, New York cab driver suicides, picketing hospitality workers, and the fear that we are not prepared in the service industries for the job displacement. So, you know, some of the topics are like heavy, but then we also do, you know. So I would love to get your feedback. Like, what do you think you would like to see at events that you're not seeing?
Awesome. And can people reach out to you with that?
They sure can. I'm Charlie at tech2025.com. And in social media, on Twitter, I'm at It's Complicated.
All right. Great. Yeah. Charlie Oliver, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm pretty much going to find you somewhere and heckle you.
All right. Awesome. All right. That was great, wasn't it? Now, next week, if all goes as planned, I'm actually going to be speaking to an historian who specializes in, among other things, presidential elections. And we're going to talk about how changes in technology and really with the paradigm shifts in how we communicate, radio, television, how that's changed American politics on the presidential level throughout the years. Now, just by speaking to a few people, I know that a lot of you out there are going to be just as fascinated by this topic as I am, which is a lot. So catch me next week on episode 41. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, at Max Sklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.